pain is excruciating, so Jalbert has heard, and it's the sort of wound that Coughlin might not, depending on the caliber of the slug, ever come back from.
"Maybe that's good," he shouts. "I get where you're coming from, buddy," Allard says. "And from the sound of it, I get where you are. Have one for me."
"I'll have two," Jalbert says and laughs. It's the first real laugh to come out of him in a long time, and the hangover he wakes up with the next day feels entirely justified. He takes a long walk without counting his steps, simply hoping, almost praying, that Coughlin will live but get some sort of serious infection, possibly need to have his stomach removed. Was it possible to live if that happened? Would you have to be fed through a tube? If so, wouldn't that be an even greater punishment? Jalbert thinks yes. By noon, his hangover is gone. He eats a hearty lunch and doesn't even think about going into the dining room to work on his classic movie posters puzzle. He is contemplating the idea of sending Coughlin flowers with a card reading, "Don't get well soon," when his phone rings. It's his ex-partner.
"Frank, I have some fantastic news."
"I already know. Our boy Coughlin took one in the belly. He's in the hospital."
"They caught him."
Jalbert shakes his head, not sure he's following her.
"Do you mean Yvonne Wicker's brother, or did you uncover some evidence about Coughlin?"
"Did you? Is that it?"
He could hope. Gut shot and going to prison. How beautiful that would be.
"The man who killed her. They caught him in Iowa. His name is Andrew Iverson."
Jalbert frowns. His headache is creeping back.
"I have no idea what you're talking about. Coughlin killed poor Miss
Iverson. Was trying to take another one. She stabbed him and got away."
Davis pours out the whole story, saving the best for last. Two of the charms from Yvonne Wicker's bracelet in Iverson's kill bag.
"We hounded an innocent man for nothing," she finishes, "because we couldn't believe."
Jalbert sits up straight. His headache is worse than ever. He will have to do something about it. Take some aspirin, then run the chairs.
"We didn't hound him, Ella. We pursued him. Given what we knew, we had every right, every duty."
"Stop with the wee stuff, Frank."
Now she just sounds weary.
"I didn't give his name to that free newspaper, and I didn't plant dope in his truck. You did those things on your own, and I didn't get him shot."
"You're not thinking clearly."
"That's you, not me. I told him I went to Mass and prayed for him, and do you know what he said? It helps if you believe. I'm going to keep that in mind going forward."
"Then you better quit police work and get a job as a voodoo priestess or something."
"Do you not feel the slightest shred of guilt, Frank?"
"No. I'm going to hang up now, Ella. Don't call me again."
He ends the call. He runs the chairs. He puts 10 pieces in his jigsaw puzzle and then counts steps in his backyard. 81 down to 1. A total of 3,321. A good number, but his head still aches.
62.
Danny's supper following Edgar Ball's visit is green gluck that looks like liquefied snot and tastes a little like V8. If that is, V8 tasted nasty. He gets it all down anyway, because for the first time since waking up in the hospital, he's actually hungry. In truth, for the first time since his trip to Gunnell in Dart County, things have changed. He feels saved. At 9 o'clock, a nurse comes in with a couple of pain pills. He tells her he doesn't need them, at least not yet. She raises her eyebrows. "Really? Will you be able to sleep?" "I think so. Leave them on the night table in case I want them later." She does that, checks his bandages for seepage, finds none, and wishes him a good night. Danny wishes her the same. His stomach hurts, but the pain is down to a dull throb unless he makes a sudden move.
He grabs the TV controller, switches around through a few channels, then turns it off. He thinks about Edgar Ball saying he could probably have his old job back if he wants it. The idea actually hurts. There are people in Manitou who are always going to believe he's guilty of something. Gossip is like radioactive waste. It has a long and toxic half-life. Stevie sent him an email with attachments to several rentals in Nederland and Longmont. They would have been far out of his reach a week ago, but if Edgar's right about how he, Danny, might get a little payday. He's still thinking about that when he drifts into the first good sleep he's had since the night before he dreamed that inexplicable dream. That lasts until 1:20 a.m., when the second dream begins. 63. Unless he's working a case, and thanks to Ella Davis all of that is done, Jalbert goes to bed every night at 9:30. That's supposed to be the healthiest time, according to what he's read on the internet. But tonight, he's not able to get down. Just tonight? If only. He hasn't managed more than a few light doses since finding out a wandering plumber named Andrew Iverson has been arrested for the murder of Yvonne Wicker and two others. Who is the bad guy in all of this? Frank Jalbert. And who is the loser in all of this? Frank Jalbert. 20 good years, half a dozen commendations, all flushed down the commode. Everything he dedicated his life to is gone. His name is mud. While Danny is having a good sleep in Great Bend, Jalbert is wide awake in Lawrence. His mind has turned on itself, gnawing and biting like a mangy dog snapping at its own flanks until the blood flows. After 90 minutes or so of tossing and turning, he throws back the covers and gets up. He has to walk, and he has to count. If he doesn't, he'll go crazy. The thought of sticking his gun in his mouth comes, and it's attractive. But if he does that, will he not be giving Coughlin the ultimate victory? And Ella. Ella saying, "We hounded an innocent man for nothing, because we couldn't believe." That was nonsense, not to mention Monday morning quarterbacking. Were they supposed to throw out years of fact-based police work because a high school janitor said he'd had a dream? When COVID was burning across America, they said to follow the science. When you were a policeman, you followed the logic. Did that not make sense? Or had the world gone crazy? Ella believed he killed her, he says, as he leaves the house on this hot summer night. She believed it as much as I did. He walks on West 6th Street in his bedroom slippers, past the Walgreens and the Hy-Vee, past Dillon's and Starbucks and the Big Biscuit, now closed and dark. He walks past the 6 Mile Chop House and the Alvadora Apartments, where he once arrested a murderer who is now doing his time in El Dorado. He walks all the way to the Highway 40 interchange. He counts his steps. He's up to 154, a total of 11,935 when added sequentially. Then a sudden burst of insight, of logic, lights up his mind. Did the girl in Wyoming escape Andrew Iverson? Andrew Iverson in his little plumbing and heating van? Yes, Jalbert accepts that. Did Andrew Iverson kill two other girls, one in Illinois and the other in Missouri? He accepts that, too. Did Andrew Iverson have two of the charms from poor Miss Yvonne's bracelet in his kill sack? All right, say he did. And say Danny Coughlin put them there. It makes perfect sense once you throw out the New Age bullshit. Ella may believe that crap now, but Jalbert never did and never will. Follow the science. Follow the logic. Coughlin and Iverson knew each other. He's sure of it. It stands to reason. Jalbert is also sure
that the good police work necessary to uncover that connection will never be done. Why would any KBI investigator even try when everything is tied up in a neat bow? When Danny Coughlin will probably come out of this looking like a hero who just tried to do his civic duty. A psychic hero. The only question in Jalbert's mind as he stands looking at late-night cars passing on Highway 40 is whether Iverson held poor Miss Yvonne down while Coughlin raped her, or if Coughlin held her down while Iverson did his dirt. Would they be the first kill team? No, of course not. There have been others. Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Bono, Dick Hickok and Perry Smith, those two right here in Kansas. A car goes by on 6th and a young voice sings out, "Hey, Pop, you're in your pajamas." There's diminishing laughter. Jalbert doesn't notice. He's putting the pieces together just as he put the pieces of his classic movie posters puzzle together, and they all fit. Iverson called Coughlin from wherever he picked up poor Miss Yvonne, somewhere near that gas and go down south, and asked if he, Coughlin, wanted to have a little fun. And when they were done, Coughlin stripped a couple of charms from poor Miss Yvonne's charm bracelet and told him, "Here, you take these," Jalbert mutters, "something to look at when you whack off." No bullshit about dreams, just cold logic. Coughlin thought, "I'll not only get the fun of raping her and killing her, I'll get the glory of being the one to find her." It makes perfect sense. Divine sense. Because Coughlin always knew they'd trace the source of that ridiculous anonymous call, didn't he? How could he not? It occurs to Jalbert, he's walking home now, counting forgotten, that he might be able to investigate on his own. Do some digging. Find out where the lives of Coughlin and Iverson intersected. At school, maybe. After that, emails and texts. Iverson killed others? It seems likely that Coughlin has as well. Likely. Try certain. But be real. He hasn't the resources to mount that kind of an investigation, and if he did, he'd draw attention to himself, and they, KBI, the newspapers, would shut him down. They have their story, complete with gosh, wow, dream information. No one would believe his. "Take your pension and shut up," they'd say. "You're lucky we let you have one after what you did." Which left what? Where was justice for poor Miss Yvonne? Who would be her advocate? That, too, seems perfectly clear to Jalbert. He will have to take care of Danny Coughlin himself. This very night. Tomorrow morning, the hospital where Coughlin is currently recuperating will fill with people. But in the small hours ahead, it will be at its lowest ebb. Coughlin isn't being guarded. Why would he be? When the blind idiots at KBI think poor Miss Yvonne's killer is handcuffed to his own hospital bed in Wyoming. Coughlin is the psychic hero. At home, Jalbert dresses in jeans and his black suit coat, the one he always wore when he was on the job. He puts his badge on his belt, technically against the law now that he's retired, but it will help him get in if any late shift person asks questions. To this he adds his service weapon. 64. A quarter of 2 in the morning, Charles Beeson, an orderly on the 3rd floor of Regional Hospital, is playing Fruit Ninja on his phone. "Chuck? Chuck?" He turns and is startled to see Danny Coughlin limping toward him. Danny's Johnny flaps around his knees. He's barefoot. One hand is pressed against his abdomen. Tears are running down his cheeks. They are tears of pain, but they are also tears of horror.
"Mr. Coughlin, you're not supposed to get out of bed until the doctor gives you permission."
"My phone," Danny says. He's hoarse, panting. "It's in my drawer, but the battery's dead. Please, I have to charge it up. I have to make a call."
The pain wasn't bad when he fell asleep, but walking down the hall has awakened it. He grimaces and almost falls. Chuck gets an arm around him, but that's not good enough. He hoists Danny into his arms and carries him back to his room. Once he's in bed, Chuck holds out his own phone.
Here, if it's important, use mine.
Danny shakes his head. His hair is sticking to his forehead. Sweat runs down his cheeks.
I need my contacts. I put her number in my contacts. Even 2% will be enough. I have to make that call.
65. While Danny's phone is on a charger in the nurse's station, Jalbert is on Route 56 heading for Great Bend. The interstate would be shorter, but he's less likely to run into the highway patrol on 56, and he's running hot. According to his GPS, the trip from Lawrence should take about 3.5 hours if he kept to the speed limit. But with the highway almost completely deserted at this small hour, he's doing 85. It was almost 12:30 in the morning before he got rolling. He expects to be there by 3 a.m. at the latest. 150 minutes, which is 1 to 17 when added sequentially, with 3 left over, of course, but who is counting? It's vital that he should give Coughlin the justice he will otherwise escape. Nothing must stand in his way. It will be his ultimate sacrifice to save all the girls and women Coughlin might otherwise encounter. The burner he used to call Anderson is in the center console of his car. He pre-programmed the number for the Great Bend Police Department before he left home for what will be the last time. He makes the call at 2:15 a.m., never taking his eyes off the cone of his headlights. He doesn't have the voice-altering device he used with Anderson, so when the night dispatcher answers, "Great Bend Police, how may I help?" Jalbert just makes his voice a little higher. He hopes he sounds like an adolescent, but it doesn't really matter. They will respond. On calls like this, they must respond.
"There's going to be an explosion at the high school, a big one. It's going to happen around the time the kids start arriving."
And then it just pops out.
"3.
"Sir, where are you calling from?"
"3 bombs," he says, improvising on the fly. "3. They want to take out the whole school."
"Sir,"
Jalbert ends the call. He throws the phone out the driver's side window without slowing down. They may find the phone, and if they do, they'll find his prints when they dust it, but it doesn't matter. He won't be coming back from this,
and that will be a relief.
66.
When Chuck, the orderly, brings Danny his phone, it's 5% charged. That should be enough.
"Listen to me, Chuck. I want you to get the night nurses, Karen and the other one, the blonde, I can't remember her name, and go down to the second floor."
"What? Why?"
"Just trust me. There isn't much time."
Danny glances at the clock on his nightstand. 2:10 a.m. Chuck is still standing in the door, frowning at him.
"Go! It's life and death. Not kidding."
"You're not having a pain med reaction, are you?"
"Belief," Danny thinks. "It's all about belief, isn't it?"
"No. Second floor. All of you. This will be over one way or the other in an hour. Until then, get out. Get safe."
He goes to his contacts. For a moment, he's terrified that Davis isn't in them, that he only thought he added her number from the card she gave him. But it's there, and he makes the call, praying her phone isn't shut off. It rings 4 times, then 5. Just as he's despairing, she answers. Sleepy, she sounds more human than ever.
"Hello? Who?"
"Danny Coughlin," he says. "Wake up, Inspector Davis. Listen to me. I had another dream. This time it was premonitory. Do you understand?" A moment's silence. When she replies, she sounds more awake.
"Do you mean he's coming for me? Unless something changes it, there's going to be shooting down the hall. I think at the nurse's station. Screaming. Then he's here, dressed like he was when you first came to the school. Black coat, blue jeans, Only that time he wasn't armed. This time he is.
I'll call the police, she says. But if this is some kind of weird joke...
Do I sound like I'm joking? He almost screams it. The police won't come. He sent them off on some kind of wild goose chase. Don't ask me how I know that. It wasn't in the dream, but I...
It's what he'd do, she says. If he really means to come after you. Yes, it's what he'd do. She sounds fully awake now. I'll call the cops in Dundee and Pawnee Rock, and then I'll come myself. I'm at my sister's, only 6 miles from Regional. The second dream is as clear in his memory as the dream of County Road F, the Texaco station, and the constant tinka, tinka, tinka of those price signs against the rusty pole. As real as the dog and the unearthed arm. There were, will be, shots at the nurse's station, followed by a single scream, a man's scream, so probably Chuck the orderly. And then the man in the black coat and the dad jeans was, will be, standing in his doorway, looming in his doorway. That strange peninsular widow's peak surrounded by white skin, those deep-set, tired eyes. For poor Miss Yvonne, he'll say as he raises the gun. And just as he fires, Danny turns his head on the pillow. He looks at the clock on his night table.
I told the orderly to send everyone down to the second floor, but they're not going. I can hear them down there. They don't believe me. Just like him. Just like you.
He looked at the clock in his dream. He looks at it now.
Forget about Dundee and Pawnee Rock, Inspector. They're too far away. He's going to start shooting at 3:01. You've got 39 minutes to do something about it.
67. Ella's sister Regina is alone in the master bedroom. Her husband is away on one of his many business trips. Davis has her suspicions about those trips, and she supposes Regina does too, but that is a matter for another time. The digital clock beside Regina's bed reads 2:24.
Reg! Reggie, wake up!
Regina stirs and opens her eyes. Davis is wearing jeans, sneakers without socks, and a KU t-shirt, clearly without a bra. But it's the sight of the gun on her hip and the ID laminate her sister is slipping over her head that wakes her all the way up.
What?
I have to go. Right now. I'll be back before Lori wakes up. She hopes so, at least. There's a problem.
What problem?
I can't explain, Reg. I hope it's nothing. She doesn't believe that. Not anymore. She believes, Coughlin, about everything. She can only hope it's not too late.
I'll call when it's taken care of.
Reggie is still asking questions when her sister leaves. Ella runs down the stairs 2 at a time and snatches her keys from the basket by the door. Her personal car is parked in the driveway, and goddamn, Regina parked hers directly behind it. Davis pulls forward until the collision monitor hollers and her bumper thumps the porch. She cranks the wheel and backs around Reggie's Subaru, hitting the Subaru's bumper hard enough to rock it on its springs. She misses the mailbox by inches when she reverses into the street. She looks at the dashboard clock. It's 2:28. The streets are deserted, and she ignores the stop signs, only slowing to look for headlights coming in either direction. She takes 7th, which proves to be a mistake. There's construction. A line of smudge pots in front of a hole in the road, probably meant for a culvert. The pots glow smoky orange in the night. She wheels into someone's driveway, turns back, and takes 8th, hating the delay. She works her phone out of her pocket, and when she comes to a blinker flashing red at the McKinley Street intersection, she tells Siri to call the Great Bend PD. Davis identifies herself and tells dispatch as a possible shooter approaching Regional Hospital send any and all available officers. Dispatch tells her she has no one to send. Someone has phoned in a bomb threat at the high school. 3 bombs, in fact, and the few officers working the night shift have gone there to close off the streets leading to the building. The bomb squad is on its way from Wichita.
There's no bomb, Davis says. This guy wants to draw your cops off until he finishes what he's coming to do. Ma'am? Inspector? You know this how?
The clock on her dashboard reads 2:39. It occurs to Ella that lack of belief is the curse of intelligence. She throws her phone on the passenger seat without ending the call and turns on to McKinley. She floors it, then stamps both feet on the brake as a late-night shambler pushes a shopping cart into the street. She lays both hands on the horn. The shambler gives her a lazy middle finger, tick-tocking it from side to side as he continues on his way. Davis veers around him and tromps the gas, laying 50 feet of rubber. Here, at last, is Cleveland Street and the bulk of the hospital. The red emergency sign over the portico is her beacon. It's 2:46. Beat him, Davis thinks. If Danny was right about the time, I beat him. A red SUV looms up in her rear view. It swings beside her, almost sideswipes her, then bolts ahead. Davis gets just a glimpse of the driver, but a glimpse is enough. That thick widow's peak is all the ID she needs. Taillights flash as the SUV pulls up in front of the main entrance. Jalbert gets out. Black coat, baggy dad jeans. In spite of her terror and the sense that she's having her own dream, it's hardly been an hour since she was called from a sound sleep by her phone, after all. There's a feeling of almost miraculous wonder, because Danny was right about everything, and now she knows how he must have felt at that Texaco station, seeing his dream made real. She doesn't slow, simply rear-ends Jalbert's vehicle. He wheels around, eyes wide, going for his gun. Ella lays on the horn with her right hand. Wake up, you people, wake up! And opens the door with her left. She draws her own gun as she gets out, hoping two things, that she won't have to shoot her ex-partner, and that her ex-partner won't shoot her. She has a little girl to go back to. Frank, stop. Do not go in. Ella, what are you doing here? He looks so haggard, she thinks, so lost, and so dangerous. Put your gun away, Frank. People are coming out now. Nurses in pink and blue rayon, a couple of orderlies in white, a doctor in green scrubs, a couple of patients from 24-hour care, one with his arm in a sling.
He's lying, Ella. Of course he is. Are you blind?
They are pointing Glocks at each other like a pair of gunfighters at the end of a Western movie. The 40 S&W ammo those guns fire will be lethal at this short range. If the shooting starts, one or both of them will almost certainly be killed.
No, Frank. They caught the doer in Wyoming. His name is Andrew
Iverson, yes.
Jalbert is nodding.
I believe that, but they were in it together.
Can't you see that?
Follow the logic, Ella. They were a kill team. Use your brain. How can you believe his story? You're too smart. 16 times too smart. 18 times too smart.
More people have come out. They cluster on the steps. Davis wants to tell them to go back in, but she doesn't dare take her eyes off Jalbert. Now she can hear a siren. It's approaching, but it's too far, too far.
Frank, why do you think I'm here? How do you think I got here?
For the first time, he looks unsure.
I don't know.
Danny called me. He knew you were coming. He dreamed it.
That's ridiculous. A lie. A fable for children.
But here I am. How else can you explain it?
A nurse, a large woman in a blue smock, has come out of urgent care and is now sneaking up on Jalbert from behind. Ella wants to tell her that's a bad idea, the worst idea, but doesn't dare. Jalbert will think she's trying to distract him and he'll shoot.
I can't, Jalbert says. You shouldn't be here. I don't think you are here. You're a halluc.
The big woman throws her arms around Jalbert, pinning his arms,
She must outweigh him by 60 pounds, but his reaction is immediate. He stamps down on one of her feet. She screams. Her grip loosens. He frees one arm and drives an elbow backward into her throat. The nurse stumbles away, gagging. He turns toward her and away from Davis.
Frank, put it down. Drop it, drop it, drop it.
He doesn't seem to hear her. The nurse is bent over, hands to her throat. Jalbert raises the gun. He does it very slowly. Ella has time to think about all the miles they've driven on Kansas roads and all the meals they've eaten in Kansas diners, prepping each other before testifying, sitting through endless briefings. There's time to shoot him, but she doesn't. Can't. She can only watch as Jalbert continues to raise the gun, but he's not pointing it at the nurse. He puts it to his own head.
Frank, don't. Please don't.
I did it all for poor Miss Yvonne. Then he says, 3, 2, 1, and pulls the trigger.
68. It's almost an hour later when Ella is finally allowed into Danny Coughlin's room. Two cops are standing guard outside his door. She thinks this is a perfect example of locking the barn after the horse has been stolen. Chuck, the orderly, is there, and a doctor. Ella thinks it's the one she saw on the steps during the final confrontation, but she might be wrong. They all look the same in their green scrubs. In his hospital, Johnny, Danny looks like he's lost 40 pounds. He's as haggard as Jalbert was at the end, but there's a clarity in his face that's different. Ella doesn't hesitate. She goes to him and hugs him. I'm sorry. I'm sorry about everything. It's all right, Danny tells her. He strokes her hair. That seems like the wrong thing to do. It also seems right. She pulls back from him.
Ma'am, the doctor says, this man has had enough excitement for one night. He needs his rest.
I know. I'll go. But Danny, why did you have that dream? Why? Do you have any idea at all?
He laughs. It's a sorry laugh. Why does a man get hit by lightning twice?
She shakes her head. I don't know.
Neither do I.
He points. I see you wearing your cross. She touches it. I always wear it.
Sure. But belief is hard, isn't it? He lies down on his pillow, puts his hands over his eyes, as if to blot out both worlds, the one seen and the one behind it, so rarely revealed, and says it again.
Belief is hard.
He drops his hands. They look at each other without speaking. There's nothing to say.
Finn had a hard go of it from the very beginning. He slipped through the hands of a midwife who had delivered hundreds of babies and gave his birthday cry when he hit the floor. When he was 5, there was a house party next door. He was allowed out to listen to the music, the Pogues blasting from pole-mounted portable speakers on his side of the street. It was summer. He was barefoot, and a cherry bomb thrown by an exuberant partygoer flew up, arced down with the stub of its fuse fizzing, and blew off the baby toe on his left foot.
Wouldn't have happened again in 1,000 years, his grandma said.
At 7, he and his sisters were playing in Pettingill Park while Grandma sat on a nearby bench, alternately knitting and doing one of her word search puzzles. Finn didn't care for the swings, had no use for the seesaws, could have cared less about the roundy round. What he liked was the twisty, an entrancing curlicue of blue plastic 20 feet high. There were steps, but Finn preferred to climb the slide itself on his hands and knees, up and around, up and around. At the top, he would sit and glide to the packed dirt at the bottom. He never had an accident on the twisty.
Stop that a while, why don't ya? Grandma said one day.
You're always on that old twisty. Try something new. Try the monkey bars. Show me a trick.
His sisters, Colleen and Marie, were on them, climbing and swinging like, well, like monkeys. So to please Grandma, he went on the monkey bars and slipped while hanging upside down and fell and broke his arm. His teacher that year, pretty Miss Monahan, liked to end each day by saying, "What have we learned today, kiddos?" At the urgent care, while having his arm set, the lollipop he was given afterward hardly seemed adequate compensation for the pain, Finn thought what he'd learned that day was, "Stick to the twisty." At 14, running home from his friend Patrick's house in a driving thunderstorm, a stroke of lightning hit the street directly behind him, close enough to frizz his hair and char a line down the back of his jacket. Finn fell forward, hit his head on the curb, suffered a concussion, and lay unconscious in his bed for 2 days before waking up and asking what happened. It was Deidre Hanlon, from across the street, one of the partygoers on that long-ago Pogues Day, although not the cherry bomb thrower, who saw him and fished the unconscious boy out of the gutter. "I thought poor old Finn was dead for sure," she said. His late father said Finn was born under a bad sign. Grandma, who never apologized for the monkey bars day, held a different view. She told Finn that for every stroke of bad luck God dealt out, he gave 2 strokes of the good. Finn thought that over and said he'd had no good luck to speak of, unless it wasn't being hit dead center by the lightning bolt.
"You should be glad your luck's out," Grandma said. "Maybe it will come in all at once and you'll win the lotto, or a rich relative will die and leave you everything."
"I don't have any rich relatives."
"That you know of," Grandma said. She was the kind of woman who always got the last word. "When things go wrong, just remind yourself, God owes me, and God always pays his debts." Not soon enough to suit Finn, however. Worse luck awaited.
One evening, in his 19th year, Finn came running home from his girlfriend's house, not because it was raining, but because even with a case of blue balls, all that hugging and touching and smooching had left him exhilarated. He felt he had to run or explode. He was wearing a leather jacket, jeans, a cabin-tealy cap, and a vintage T-shirt with the logo of an old band, Nazareth, on the front. He rounded the corner onto Peak Street and ran into a young man running the other way. They both fell down. Finn picked himself up and started to apologize, but the young man was already legging it again, looking back over his shoulder. He was also wearing jeans, a bill cap, and a T-shirt, which didn't strike Finn as particularly coincidental. In this city, it was the uniform of the young, men and women both. Finn carried on running down Peak, rubbing a scraped elbow as he went. A black tradesman's van came toward him, lights off. Finn thought nothing of it until it pulled up beside him, and some men, at least 4, came rushing out of the back even before the van had rolled completely to a stop. 2 of them grabbed him by the arms. Finn managed, "Hey!" A 3rd man said, "Hey yourself!" and pulled a bag over his head. There was a sting in his upper arm, just above his scraped elbow. He was aware of being hustled, feet not touching the pavement, and then the world flew away. When Finn came to, he was lying on a cot in a small room with a high ceiling. In one corner was a table lamp with no table beneath it. In another was a commode. The commode was blue plastic, exactly the same shade as the twisty in Pettingill Park. There was no other furniture. There was a skylight, but it had been painted black in slopping, careless strokes. Finn sat up and winced. He didn't have a headache exactly, but his neck was terribly stiff, and his arm hurt the way it had after he'd gotten his COVID shot. He looked at it and saw someone had put a sticking plaster above his scraped elbow. He peeled it back and saw a tiny hole with a red corona around it. Finn tried the door and found it locked. He knocked, then pounded on it. As if in answer, AC/DC blasted at him. Dirty deeds done dirt cheap, at what sounded like 2,000 decibels. Finn clapped his hands over his ears. It went on for 20 or 30 seconds, then stopped. He looked up and saw 3 speakers mounted high up. To him, they looked like Bose models, which meant expensive. In the corner above the table lamp without a table, the lens of a camera stared down at him. Unlike the time when he had almost been struck by lightning, Finn remembered what had happened before he temporarily lost the plot and guessed what it meant. It was absurd, but not amazing. Being kidnapped was just another example of Finn Murray luck. He went back to pounding on the door and yelling for someone to come. When no one did, he stepped back and looked up at the camera.
Is someone there? Like monitoring this? If you are, please come and let me out. I believe you dropped a bollock. You want the other fella?
There was no response for almost a full minute. Finn was walking back to the cot, having decided to lie down until someone came to rectify what was obviously a mistake when the speakers blared again. Finn liked the Ramones, but not at such apocalyptic volume in a closed room. This time, the sonic assault went on for about 2 minutes before cutting out just as abruptly. He lay on the cot and had just begun to drift when Cheap Trick roared down. 20 minutes later, it was Dexy's Midnight Runners. It went on that way for quite some time, probably hours. There was no way Finn could tell for sure. His captors had taken his watch while he was unconscious. He was dozing when the door opened. 2 men came in. Finn wasn't sure they were the ones who had grabbed him by the arms, but pretty sure. One of them had a droopy eye. He said,
"Are you going to be troublesome, Bobby-O?"
"Not if you're going to make this right," Finn said. He took little notice of being called Bobby-O, thought it was just some kind of nickname like Daddy-O, or how if his father had seen a drunk staggering up the street, he'd always say, "There goes Paddy O'Reilly." "That's up to you," the other said. He had a narrow face and black eyes like a weasel. They went out the door, Finn between the 2 men, who were both wearing chinos and white shirts. Neither of them had a gun, which was a bit of a comfort, although Finn had no doubt they could handle him easily if he decided to make trouble for them. They looked fit. Finn was tall but weedy. The room they came out in was lined with shelves, all of them empty. To Finn, it looked like a pantry, or maybe, given the size, what his grandma would have called a larder. As a young woman, she'd been in service. From the pantry, they entered the biggest kitchen Finn had ever seen. There were a couple of empty bowls on the counter with spoons in them. Judging by the scum inside, he guessed they had contained soup. His belly rumbled. He didn't know how long it had been since he'd eaten. Ellie had made him some scrambled eggs before the necking started, but Finn had an idea that was long since digested. If digestion continued when you were unconscious, that was. He thought it must. A person's body just went about its business. Next came a dining room with a shining mahogany table that looked long enough to play shuffleboard on. Heavy, plum-colored drapes had been pulled all the way closed. Finn strained his ears for the sound of passing traffic and heard nothing. They went down a hall, and the droopy-eye man opened a door on the right. The weasel gave Finn a light shove. There was a fancy desk in the room. The walls were lined with books and folders. More drapes. A deep, dull red had been drawn over the window behind the desk. A man with white hair, combed back like the early Cliff Richard, sat behind the desk. His tanned face was scored with lines. He looked not much older than Finn's father had been when he died. "Sit down." Finn sat down across from the white-haired man. Mr. Droopy Eye stood in one corner. Mr. Weasel stood in the other corner. They clasped their hands in front of their belt buckles. There was a folder in front of the white-haired man, thinner than the ones crammed in helter-skelter on the shelves. He opened it, lifted a sheet of paper, looked at it, and sighed. "This can be easy or hard, Mr. Feeney. That's entirely up to you." Finn leaned forward. "See, that's not my name. You have the wrong person." The white-haired man looked interested. He put the sheet of paper back in the thin folder and closed it. "Not Bobby Feeney. Is that so?"
"My name is Finn Murray. That's Murray, with an I-E at the end, not A-Y.
He felt that this detail alone should be enough to convince the white-haired man. It was so specific. "Is it now?" the white-haired man said.
"Will wonders never cease?"
"I'll tell you what happened, what I think happened. When I came round the corner into Peak Street, I ran into a fellow running the other way. We knocked each other down. He got up and ran on. I got up and ran on. These fellas," he pointed at the men in the corners, "must have wanted that other fella, Bobby Feeney. He was dressed the same as me."
"Dressed the same, was he? Cabin tealy cap? Nazareth t-shirt? Leather jacket?"
"Well, I don't know what was on the shirt, but I remember the cap. It all happened fast, but it's sure that's who you wanted. This happens to me all the time."
The white-haired man leaned forward, his hands, scarred, Finn saw, or maybe burned, clasped on his thin folder. He looked more interested than ever.
"You are taken into custody all the time, are you?"
"No. Bad luck. Bad luck happens to me all the time." He told the white-haired man about being dropped at birth, and the cherry bomb, the broken arm because he let his grandma coax him off the twisty, the lightning strike. There were other things he could have added, but he thought the lightning strike and resulting concussion made a good place to stop, like the climax of a storybook story.
"So you see, I'm not the boyo you're looking for."
"Huh." The white-haired man sat back, pressed a hand to his belly as if it pained him, and sighed. Inspiration struck Finn.
"Just think about it, sir. If I was running away from these fellows of yours, I'd run away. But I didn't, did I? I ran right into their outstretched arms, so to speak. It was the other fella, this Bobby Feeney, who ran away."
"You're not Bobby Feeney?"
"No, sir."
"You're Finn Donovan."
"Finn Murray, with an I-E.
This should have been settled by now. That it apparently was not gave Finn a bad feeling.
"Do you have any identification? Because if you had a wallet,
it must be crammed up your arse. That's the only place we didn't look."
Finn actually reached for his back pocket before remembering. "I left it at my girlfriend's house. We were sitting on the couch, lying on it, actually. Ellie on top. And it was digging into my butt, so I took it out and put it on this little table with our cans of lager. I must have forgotten it."
"Forgot it," said Mr. Weasel, grinning.
"Stands to reason,"
said Mr. Droopy Eye. He was grinning, too.
"You see, we have a problem here already," the white-haired man said.
Finn had another inspo. The unpleasant situation he was in, the unbelievable situation, really, although he had no choice but to believe it, seemed to be bringing inspirations on thick and fast.
"I had my Odeon card in my pocket. I kept it separate in case Ellie wanted to go out to the Royale."
He felt for the card. It wasn't there. The white-haired man opened his folder, riffled through the few papers inside, and brought out an orange card.
"This card?"
"Yes, that's it. See my name?" He reached for it. The white-haired man leaned back.
Mr. Weasel and Mr. Droopy Eye unclasped their hands, ready to pounce, should pouncing be called for. The white-haired man held the card close to his face as if he were nearsighted.
"Finn Murray,
it says here, with an A-Y.
Finn felt heat rising in his cheeks as if he had been caught in a lie. He hadn't been, but that was how it felt.
People misspell names all the time. My father's name was Stephen, and people were always for spelling it with a V or even an F, like Stefan.
The white-haired man slipped the Odeon card back into his folder.
Did you enjoy the music we had piped into your room?
I know why you do that. I've seen it on telly. It's a tactic, like, to keep people on edge.
Ah, is that why we do it?
Pando, did you know that's why we do it?
Hard to say, Mr. Weasel replied with a shrug. I have heard it said that music soothes the savage beast, although I'm not sure that speaks to your question.
We can arrange some Nazareth, if you like, said the white-haired man, you being a fan and all. And with what sounded grotesquely like pride, we have Spotify. I want to go home. Finn didn't like the tremble he heard in his voice, but couldn't help it. You made a mistake, and I want to go home. I won't say nothing. He was sorry as soon as it came out. Kidnapped victims were always saying it, and it never worked. He'd seen that on telly, too.
Going home might also be arranged, and very easily. But first, you must answer one question. What did you do with the briefcase, Bobby? The one with the papers in it? For you surely didn't have it when you were brought here.
Finn felt tears sting at the corners of his eyes.
Sir?
Call me Mr. Ludlam, if you like. I used to call myself Mr. Dayton, but I got tired of it.
Mr. Ludlam, I'm not Bobby Feeney. And I didn't have any briefcase.
I never did. I'm not who you're looking for. And while you're gassing at me, the fella you are looking for is getting away.
So, your name is Bobby Murray, with an I-E.
Yes, I mean, no, I'm Finn Murray. Finn.
Doc, the white-haired man, Mr. Ludlam nodded to the one with the droopy eye. Help this fine young man to remember his name.
Doc stepped forward. Pando, a.k.a. Mr. Weasel, grabbed Finn by the shoulders. Doc removed a heavy ring, put it in the pocket of his chinos, and slapped Finn across the face good and hard. Then he went the other way, even harder. Spit flew from the side of Finn's mouth. It hurt plenty, but what he felt most in that moment was astonishment and shame. He had nothing to be ashamed of, but ashamed he was.
Now, Mr. Ludlam said, leaning back and clasping his hands on his midsection, what is your name?
Finn. Finn Mur.
Mr. Ludlam nodded to Doc, who administered two more brisk slaps.
Finn's ears rang. His cheeks burned. The tears came. You can't do that. Why would you do that? You made a mistake.
I can do it. Mr. Ludlam opened his folder and tossed a pamphlet across the desk. Open-handed slaps are a world-approved technique for advanced interrogation. I think you should read that carefully before we talk again. See what other techniques we might decide to employ. Take him back, you two. Mr. Bobby Donovan has some homework to do.
You don't even know who you're...
He was jerked to his feet, Pando on one side and Doc on the other.
Pando picked up the pamphlet and stuffed it into the waistband of Finn's jeans.
Come along, Bobby-o, he said. Ta-ta, said Mr. Ludlam. Be a friend to all, and all will be a friend to you.
With that, Finn was hustled from the study, with his cheeks burning and tears streaming from his eyes. Back in his room, his cell, Finn pulled the pamphlet free of his jeans and looked at it. There was no binding, not even a staple. It was just a few sheets of paper folded together. On the front, smearily printed and slightly askew, was this. World-approved techniques, T-E-C-H-N-E-E-K-S, for advanced interrogation,
Interrogation.
Are you shitting me?
Finn asked. He spoke in a whisper, so the mics, surely there were mics as well as a camera staring down, wouldn't pick it up. His first thought was that the pamphlet was a joke. But the slaps hadn't been a joke. His face still burned. The first page of the pamphlet.
Open-handed slaps. Okay.
The second page. Sleep deprivation techniques. Loud music, sound effects, etc.
Okay.
Third page. Threats to family members, fuck buddies, etc.
Okay.
Fourth. Enemas.
Okay.
Fifth. Stress positions.
Okay.
Sixth. Waterboarding.
Okay.
Seventh. Fist hitting, foot paddling, burning with cigarettes or lighters, L-I-T-E-R-S, rape and sexual abuse, not okay. Eighth. If not specifically mentioned, probably okay. The rest of the pages were blank.
They can't even fucking spell,
Finn whispered. But if it wasn't a mistake, or someone's macabre idea of a joke, it could mean he was in the hands of psychopaths. The idea was more terrifying than believing it was a case of mistaken identity. That could be resolved. One of his grandma's aphorisms, she had many, came to mind.
Most people will be reasonable if you speak soft and give them a chance.
Because he had no better idea, he dropped the pamphlet on the floor, got up, and faced the camera. He spoke soft. My name is Finn Murray. I live at 19 Rowan Tree Road with my grandma and my two sisters, Colleen and Marie. My mother is away on business, but she can be reached on her mobile at... Finn reeled off the number. All of them will tell you I am who I say I am. Then what? Inspiration came, or logic, maybe both. Then you can put a bag over my head, even knock me out again if you feel like you need to, and drop me off on some random street corner. You can do that because I don't know who you are, and I don't know where this is. I don't have no briefcase, and I don't have no papers. Just, you know, be reasonable, please. He'd lost track of how many times he'd said please, quite a few for sure. Finn went back to the cot and lay down. He began to drift. Just as he was slipping away, anthrax came ripping out of the speakers. Madhouse. He almost fell off the cot. He covered his ears. After 2 minutes that seemed much longer, the music stopped. He no longer felt sleepy, but he felt plenty hungry. Would they feed him? Maybe not. Starving a prisoner wasn't specifically mentioned, so it was probably okay. He slept. They gave him 4 hours. Then they came for him. Finn didn't see if it was Doc and Pando or some of the other ones. Before he realized what was happening, he was hauled to his feet, still mostly asleep. A bag came down over his head. It smelled vaguely of chicken dirt. He was propelled forward and slammed into the side of the door.
"Whoops, sorry," someone said. "A little off course there, Bobby."
He was yanked back and propelled forward again. His nose was bleeding, maybe broken. He snuffled up blood, choked, began to cough. They were moving him at suicidal speed, his paddling feet barely touching the floor. They came to stairs, and he was driven down them like a hog in a chute. Near the bottom, they let go, and one of the men gave him a hearty push. Finn screamed into the bag, imagining a drop of 100, 200, 300 feet with broken-body death awaiting him upon touchdown. It was only 2 or 3 steps. His foot caught on the bottom one, and he went sprawling. He was grabbed again. Every time he pulled in a breath, the bag went into his mouth, and he tasted his own blood, fresh and still warm, set off by a soupçon of chicken shit.
Stop it! He screamed. Stop it! I can't breathe!
Pull the other one, Bobby, one of them said. The not breathing part comes later.
His knees hit something hard. He was whacked open-handed across the back of the neck and he fell forward onto what felt like a bench.
Gotta flip the omelet so it won't bend,
someone said cheerily, and he was turned over. One of his flailing hands hit something soft.
Off my crotch, faggot, a new voice said, and he was slapped through the back. That's strictly my girlfriend's property.
Please,
Finn said. He was crying, trying not to choke on the blood now running down his throat. His nose throbbed like an infected tooth.
Please don't. Please stop. I'm not the guy. I'm not Bobby Donovan.
Someone fetched the side of his face a tremendous whack.
Bobby Feeney, you stupid git.
A cloth was draped over the bag. The first voice said,
Here it comes, Bobby.
Boosh. Warm water soaked the cloth, then the bag, then Finn's face.
He sucked water in
and splattered it out again.
He held his breath. The water continued to pour down. At last he had to breathe. Instead of air,
he sucked in water. He gargled it, choked on it, spit it out, swallowed more.
There was no air. Air was gone. Air was a golden oldie, a blast from the past.
He was drowning. Finn thrashed. The water continued to pour through the hood.
There was no sense of drifting away, no peace, only the horror of the constant water. He reached for unconsciousness and couldn't find it. Only more water.
At last it stopped. They rolled him on his side. He vomited into the bag. One of the men patted it gently all around.
A puke facial, he exclaimed, and we don't even charge.
They rolled him on his back and yanked the hood off. He was allowed a hand free to wipe his face. He coughed and coughed while he did it.
At last his vision cleared enough for him to see Mr. Ludlam peering down at him. Because he was at the head of the bench, he looked upside down.
Are you Bobby Feeney or Finn Murray? Mr. Ludlam asked. Finn was at first coughing too hard to answer. When it eased a little, he said,
Whichever you want. I'll swear to it. Just don't do it again. Please, no more.
Let's say investigation has proved to our satisfaction that you are Murray, rather than Feeney. Where is he?
Who?
Mr. Ludlam nodded. One of the men, not Doc, not Pando, they weren't here, fetched him a terrific open-handed wallop. A mixture of vomit and water flew.
Feeney! Feeney, Feeney, where is he?
I don't know.
Where is the bomb factory?
Last chance, my boy, before you enjoy another baptism.
Finn coughed, choked, turned his head to the side, heaved, spat.
You said papers. Papers in a briefcase.
Papers be damned. Where is the bomb factory?
I don't know anything about...
Mr. Ludlam nodded. The wet cloth went over Finn's face. The water began to flow.
Soon, he wanted to die. He wanted that more than anything, but he didn't.
At last, semi-conscious, with the puke-stained bag once more over his head, he was brought back to his cell. He was no longer hungry. There was that, at least.
The last thing Mr. Ludlam said before closing the door was, It doesn't have to be this way, Finn. Tell us what Feeney did with the blueprints, and this can end.
There were no blasts of music,
but Finn was still unable to sleep for a long time. Every time he started to drift, a new coughing fit would shake him awake. The last one was so furious he thought he might pass out, which would be welcome.
Anything to escape this nightmare. The skylight high above him sent a few slices of subdued light through the slopped-over black paint. Outside, in a world that was no longer his, it was daytime. And maybe early. Maybe late. Whichever it was, there were people out there,
going about their business, with no idea that in this cell, a young man with no luck, but bad luck, was trying to cough water out of his lungs. For every stroke of bad luck God deals out, his grandma had said, he gives 2 strokes of the good.
I don't believe it,
Finn croaked, and finally fell asleep. He dreamed of Pettingill Park. Colleen was on the roundy round. Marie was on the monkey bars, hanging upside down and picking her nose, a habit of which she could not be broken. Grandma said Marie would pick her nose on her deathbed. That elderly lady sat on a nearby bench with her knitting in her lap as she frowned over her latest word search. Finn climbed the spiral curves of the twisty on his hands and knees, then sat and slid down again and again and again. There were no musical interludes to interrupt this pleasant dream, which finally slipped away unnoticed, as dreams mostly do. He was awakened by Doc and another man, much older than the others, some unknown time later. They yanked him off the cot and hustled him back through the kitchen and dining room to the study where white-haired Mr. Ludlam awaited. The white-haired Mr. Ludlam seemed a bit grizzled this morning. It was morning to Finn, at least. His eyes were rimmed with red, and there was what looked like a mustard stain on his shirt. His hands were folded on the desk again, and Finn observed his scarred knuckles looked swollen. Stained, too. Was that blood? Mr. Ludlam stared at him. Finn stared back, thinking of something else he'd seen on the telly. One of the boring and endless panel discussions on BBC that Finn's mother seemed to enjoy for reasons he and his sisters and grandma, who liked Coronation Street, EastEnders, and Doctor Who, could never understand. This panel had been talking about enhanced interrogation techniques, a.k.a. torture, and one of the panelists, a jowly man who looked like Prince Andrew might after a year in a dark room drinking milkshakes and eating double burgers, said that it never worked. Because if the poor fellow don't know what his interlocutors want to find out, he'll make something up. Stands to reason. It did stand to reason, and Finn was an inventive lad, inventive enough to have gotten out of any number of minor scrapes at home, in school, and around the neighborhood. But inventive or not, he couldn't think of a story that would satisfy Mr. Ludlam and keep him from another near drowning. Finn could have made up a tale about the missing briefcase, could even have added in the blueprints. But was he supposed to say that the missing blueprints were stashed in a briefcase in the bomb factory? It sounded like something from that Cluedo board game. And what might come next? Stolen submarine parts? Hacked passwords to the bank accounts of Russian oligarchs? Meanwhile, Mr. Ludlam went on staring.
I'm hungry, Finn blurted. Could I possibly have something to eat, sir?
Mr. Ludlam went on staring. Just when Finn decided he wasn't going to speak, that he was in some kind of trance, Mr. Ludlam said,
How does the full Irish sound to you, Mr. Herlihy?
Finn gaped. Mr. Ludlam laughed.
Just yanking your lower extremity, Finn. Finn now, Finn forever. What do you say to the whole shooting match? Eggs, bacon, mushroomies, and a nice plump banger with a tomato for good looks?
Finn's stomach gurgled. That made Mr. Ludlam laugh again.
Asked and answered, I'd say. By the hair of my chinny-chin-chin, not to mention my finny-fin-fin. Eh? Eh?
Are you all right, Mr. Ludlam? This was a strange question for Finn to ask, given the circumstances. But the man seemed to have lost some of his sangy-froidy, as Grandma said when someone on a quiz program couldn't come up with the proper answer and the time ticked away to nothing.
I am swell, Mr. Ludlam said. A swell fella. is what I am. You shall have breakfast, Finn, if you can tell me the names of three songs by the late Elvis Presley.
Finn didn't bother asking why. The man was clearly crazy, but instead thought back to his grandma's extensive record collection. One of her favorites, played until the grooves had a strange whitish look as if dusted with chalk, was called 50 Million Elvis Fans Can't Be Wrong. Colleen and Marie thought those millions of fans could be wrong. They made faces and clapped their hands over their ears when she put it on. But did Grandma mind? She did not. He said, "You'll really give me breakfast?" Mr. Ludlam put his hand over his heart, and yes, those were almost surely bloodstains grimed into his knuckles. "My word on it." Finn said, "All right. I got stung. That's one. One night of sin, that's two. And a bigger, bigger hunk of love, that's three."
"Very good."
The oldish man was standing in the corner, hands clasped in front of his chinos. Mr. Ludlam turned to him and said,
"Breakfast for our friend Finn, Marm. He has rung the bell."
Marm left. Doc stayed. Finn thought Doc looked tired and maybe sad.
"You know your Elvis songs," Mr. Ludlam said. He leaned forward, gazing at Finn from eyes that were bloodshot as well as red-rimmed. "But do you know Elvis? Do you know the King of Rock and Roll?"
Finn shook his head. All he knew about Elvis was that he was some old-time bugger who died on the toilet, and that Grandma loved him. She'd probably screamed for him in the days of her youth.
"He was a twin," Mr. Ludlam breathed, and the smell of alcohol, maybe scotch, maybe whiskey, drifted to Finn from across the desk. "A twin, but also a single birth. How do you explain that paradox?"
"I don't know."
"Then I'll tell you. The future king of rock and roll absorbed his twin brother in utero. Ate him in an act of fetal cannibalism."
Finn was momentarily shocked out of his own troubles. He was sure, fairly sure, that Elvis's twin brother was as mythical as the briefcase full of stolen papers or the supposed bomb factory. But the idea of fetal cannibalism was strangely fascinating.
"Can that actually happen?" "Can and did," Mr. Ludlam said. "My dear old mother was very prim and proper, but she had a coarse joke about Mr. Presley. She said he was Elvis the pelvis, and his twin brother would have been Enos the penis. Do you get it, Finn?"
Finn nodded, thinking, "I am being held prisoner and tortured by a man who believes I know where there's a bomb factory, and that Elvis Presley gobbled up his twin brother while still in his mother's belly."
"I always found Elvis a trifle gay," Mr. Ludlam said in a ruminative tone. "There are songs. Teddy Bear is one. Wooden Heart is another. When he sings in a kind of whispery falsetto, one can almost envision him prancing in the studio as he warbled, arms outstretched, fingers gently waving, perhaps in patent leather shoes. I never believed that story about Elvis and Nick Adams. Total rot.
But the rhinestone outfits he wore toward the end,
and the scarves. There were rumors of a girdle. Yes, there was something there, something we might call latent." And he stopped, sighed, and briefly covered his face. When he lowered his hands, he said, "Two of my men have left me, Finn. Scarpered. Did a bunk. Buggered off. I tried to persuade them to stay, but they feel our enemies are closing in. The putain de bagnole, so to speak."
He drooped one bloodshot eye in a wink.
"So,
Our time has grown short. I'll send you back to your quarters now to eat your breakfast. But think very carefully. I'm sure you don't want to suffer any more discomfort. All we need to know is where you put the translation. And the key to the code itself, of course. We'll want that.
Doc, will you escort our young friend?
Doc went to the door and gestured for Finn, who got up and joined him.
Are you going to be good?
Doc asked.
Finn, who was thinking of bacon and eggs with mushroomies and a plump banger as well, nodded that he would be good. Absolutely.
He walked beside Doc to the kitchen, where the oldish man, Marm, was using tongs to put what looked like a perfectly fried sausage on a plate that already held 2 eggs, fried hard just the way Finn liked them, 4 strips